get involved with youth, because if they're supported and they have the people that they need in their life, they will not end up vulnerable to this issue.
A look at human trafficking and Alaska's homeless youth. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, scientists work to understand how sea ice loss impacts species beyond polar bears.
I never thought I would see this in my kind of short lifetime as a researcher, but I think I will see an ice-free Arctic Ocean before I'm done with my research career.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Alaska Pacific University offers graduate programs that deliver a distinctive education, grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules to support personal goals. Apply now at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Today is Police Memorial Day and a ceremony to remember law enforcement officers in the state who have died in the line of duty was held in Fairbanks this morning. The names of 70 Alaska law enforcement officers who have died since 1897 were read aloud. Fairbanks Police Sergeant Alan Brandt's name was the last to be read. Sergeant Brandt died after being shot responding to a call last October. A loss City Mayor Jim Matherly told ceremony attendees continues to weigh heavy on the community.
It's heartbreaking that for many years, Alan was here in this very parking lot with all of us on Police Memorial Day, honoring those who gave their lives in the line of duty. And now we stand here honoring him today.
Sergeant Brandt's widow and four young children attended this morning's ceremony. The family and representatives of the Fairbanks and North Pole Police Departments traveled to Washington, D.C. last week for national law enforcement memorial events. The federal government yesterday announced it's holding an oil and gas lease sale for more than 1 million acres in Cook Inlet this June. The offshore area spans south of Kalgan Island to north of Seldovia. The last three federal lease sales in Cook Inlet were canceled due to lack of industry interest. In a letter submitted to the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management last year, environmental groups raised concerns about oil and gas development's impact on marine species and subsistence activities. The groups also said Cook Inlet's harsh conditions make development risky. The agency said it will require mitigation efforts for all leaseholders to protect the inlet's resources. The federal sale is scheduled for June 21st. That same day, the state is also holding an oil and gas lease sale for about 4.2 million acres in the Cook Inlet region. Young people who are homeless in Alaska are at high risk for human trafficking, but there are ways to prevent the problem. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
I'm in a car with Josh Lowers, the Youth Engagement Coordinator at Covenant House Alaska, Anchorage's only homeless center for youth. I want him to show me common places where he seeks out people who might be victims of human trafficking, and he quickly corrects my assumptions.
I think far too often things get labeled and they just, oh, well, that just happens there or this happens there, but that this is an issue that's happening in the whole city and the state. Essentially, what we see and what we're able to see from a neighborhood or from a street is the low-hanging fruit. But there's so much more that's going on that's much more sophisticated that is out of sight.
Covenant House Alaska participated in Loyola University's 10-city study on labor and sex trafficking among homeless youth. More than a quarter of the 65 young people who were interviewed in Anchorage were victims of trafficking. Lowers says numbers are likely higher since they only spoke with people who were seeking services. Human trafficking is when someone is exploited through force, fraud, or coercion. It includes forcing a person to have sex in exchange for money or housing, or promising a high wage for a job and then never paying up, which can trap a person in unpaid servitude. In Anchorage, some victims were forced to sell drugs or do other criminal activity. Lowers drives around the city, past playgrounds, neighborhoods, gas stations, stores, cheap motels. All are places that vulnerable young people might hang out. He explains they're the same places that traffickers look.
So the recruiters who are trying to draw people into this lifestyle are looking for the easiest targets. And our easiest targets are those who are homeless because they don't have a place to go, they don't have folks caring for them. If they disappear, few people will notice.
77% of the young people in Anchorage who were trafficked for sex were homeless at the time. Lowers explains that often youth end up homeless because there are gaps in the system. They can't find treatment for mental health problems or addictions. They don't have support networks or housing options.
At the end of the day, it's a lack of community. So who is there for them if we're not? Traffickers.
Deborah Schilling-Wolf at the Field Center for Children's Policy, Practice, and Research was part of the National Study on Youth and Human Trafficking. The research shows that many people who are survivors of trafficking had aged out of foster care.
Often when they turn the magic age of 18 or 21, if they're in extended care, they're kind of dropped off the grid, as it were, and have to support themselves without having the skills or resources to do so.
The study also shows many trafficking victims had experienced sexual abuse or other trauma, which leads to increased vulnerability.
One young woman had said, you know, I was sexually abused as a child, and I kind of learned from that people could touch my body if they wanted to. I didn't feel that I had control or ownership.
Extensive social science research shows that one way to make young people less vulnerable to exploitation is to help them feel connected. Lowers with Covenant House says youth need caring adults in their lives who support them and know them well enough to notice changes in behavior.
Get involved with youth, because if they're supported and they have the people that they need in their life, they will not end up vulnerable to this issue. You know, I think if we want to be spectators and drive around our city and try to identify it, I think that's very difficult. It really takes getting invested in people's lives to understand and then discover that they are being exploited by something like this.
Nationwide, about 20% of homeless youth experienced trafficking. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Covenant House is participating in the Barefoot Mile this Saturday in Anchorage to raise awareness about human trafficking in the state. For more information, go to our website, alaskapublic.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juneau's homeless population reacts to being forced out of a local park.
You know, I hate to say this, but because some of these people that do meth, you know, kind of feel like they ruin it for us.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Juneau's controversial anti-camping ordinance has been in effect for more than a month. The result has been more people are sleeping in downtown's Marine Park. Now the city is looking to empty the park of overnight campers. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
It's just after 8 in the morning on Juneau's downtown waterfront. A cruise ship empties of tourists as people sprawled out on the soft grass begin to stir inside their sleeping bags. 42-year-old Lorraine Paul is one of those early risers. She and others often sleep in Marine Park, though police sometimes try to move them on.
Some of us sleep in the booth over here. We have to be up by 5:30. You know, some of them are just respectful. You know, we get up and try to come over here and lay down. And then here comes JPD, like, you need to get up, pick your stuff up.
The reason she chooses to sleep out in the open in a public park is security. There are aggressive drug addicts around who can be threatened.
You know, I hate to say this, but because some of these people that do meth, you know, kind of feel like they ruin it for us. It's really hard to find somewhere to sleep. I mean, I'm an alcoholic, you know. Some of us try to stick together and, how would I say it, pick after ourselves.
Juneau has one of the largest homeless populations in Alaska. A statewide survey in January found the capital city had 215 homeless people, 59 of them unsheltered. Earlier this year, the Assembly passed a controversial ordinance banning sleeping on private property in the downtown core. Juneau Police Lieutenant David Campbell says officers have been able to coax people away from storefronts without serious conflict.
Since the initiation of the ordinance, no citations have been issued, which means that the people are basically moving on if they're requested to.
Federal judges have ruled cities can't pass laws that criminalize homelessness. That's why the city's recent ordinance is limited to private property. So many people move to public property, like Marine Park, where Campbell says police were instructed to be more lenient about restricted hours.
With the new camping ordinances and the directions to the officers, we were told not to enforce that in Marine Park.
But soon the city will try to make Marine Park off limits after midnight.
We think that making sure that the park remains open as a park and not as a camping area is best for everyone.
That's Deputy City Manager Mila Cosgrove. She says the decision was made at a department head meeting on Tuesday. The logic is to close the downtown parks to drive people towards alternatives, such as the seasonal campground near Thane.
The thought was people would naturally migrate up to Thane as the weather got a little bit warmer, which it certainly has, and that hasn't been happening. And we want people to know that that's a designated option for them.
Complaints in recent weeks about rowdy behavior in Marine Park is what led the city to take action.
At times, people don't feel safe transiting through that area, and that's just not acceptable. Everybody has a right to feel safe.
The Tuesday afternoon directive to clear Marine Park after hours hadn't filtered down to the police lieutenant on Wednesday morning. But Campbell says it could be done. Back in Marine Park, this is not welcome news to Lorraine Paul.
Now that I hear that, we can't be sleeping out here, and it sucks. Wish they'd have somewhere for us to camp, like, you know.
What about Thane Campground? She says it's 2 miles from downtown on an unlit road, not safe for a single woman.
I just hear a lot of stories. I guess, like, if, for example, like, if I walked out there myself, I mean, I was just told that there's guys, rude guys out that way that camp that would hurt you and rape you, and it's kind of hard.
It's unclear whether the city would be able to penalize anyone caught in the park after hours. That's because there's a typo in the city's code that likely would need amending before a court could impose the $25 fine. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Sitka Community Hospital is operating in the black for the first time in several years, but its future is far from certain. CEO Rob Allen told the Sitka Chamber of Commerce this week that discussions around a possible merger with the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium have undermined the morale, if not the stability, of Sitka's local hospital. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has more.
When Rob Allen uses the word chaos, he doesn't mean that Sitka Community Hospital is in disarray. Things are actually going pretty well there. The long-term care unit is running at capacity with 14 beds, and home health is growing. Chaos is one of four ways that business managers characterize problems in the so-called Cunevin framework. You've got your simple problems, your complicated problems, and your complex problems, all of which can lead to relatively clear answers. And then there are chaotic problems.
That's what Sitka Community Hospital felt like 2 years ago when I got here. Felt very chaotic. There was a lot of unknowns and issues and spent a lot of time, you know, in those first months trying to get back to a stable situation.
Allen reported that Sitka Community Hospital has $3.8 million in cash in the bank, about 50 days worth of operational money. It's paid back half of its $1.5 million line of credit with the city, and revenues through the month of March are $242,000 ahead of budget projections. And the 2018 budget is in the black. This sounds like stability, so why this talk of chaos?
Bordering on the chaotic is really the search merger proposal. That is causing a lot of uncertainty.
Allen said that hiring has been difficult with recent news about a possible merger, and staff morale is low. The Sitka Assembly in March invited a merger proposal from Search. At the same time, the Assembly asked to see a plan from Sitka Community to remain a standalone healthcare entity in an increasingly competitive environment.
If we're going to be around operating as a standalone community hospital, we will have to change. We do have two big operational changes built into this budget. One was ending labor and delivery at the hospital. And then the other one was, when that happened, going to a halftime surgery schedule.
Allen has been careful not to come down on either side of the merger. He thinks there is strong potential for collaboration with Search in obstetrics, surgery, and behavioral health. But he's concerned about the different cultures within the organizations. Sitka Community Hospital is very local, with 200 employees. Search is regional and many times larger.
Is there a way we can preserve the strengths of both cultures and grow them? Or is it just going to be we're going to be subsumed and our culture is gone, which, you know, often happens in just a straight merger. And I think that would be a shame for the community.
And that's only one reason why the future of Sitka Community Hospital remains a complex and chaotic problem. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
It's not just walrus or polar bear. Scientists are worried the loss of Arctic sea ice may have dire consequences for several species' reproduction and growth. It's rapidly getting harder for Arctic wildlife and marine life to find their usual food sources. KTOO's Matt Miller has the story.
Polar bears have shown up even on mer colonies. Now, these are cliff nesting birds.
That's Kathy Kulitz, a bird researcher with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, talking about how at least one Arctic species is being forced to travel further to find food or look for alternative food sources. Her research is part of a new report on Arctic marine biodiversity that was issued by the Arctic Council in conjunction with their ministerial meeting in Fairbanks in May. It also describes how melting of the Arctic sea ice is forcing marine species to shift their ranges further north. In a video version of the report produced by the Arctic Council, Håkon Hoppe of the Norwegian Polar Institute says the rapid reduction of thicker multi-year and second-year ice is having a dramatic impact on the Arctic sea ice ecosystem.
I never thought I would see this in my kind of short lifetime as a researcher, but I think I will see an ice-free Arctic Ocean before I'm done with my research career.
Reduction in sea ice means changes for beluga whale migration. It also creates problems for harp seals, bearded seals, and ring seals when they have pups or try to raise them. Walrus will haul out on shore rather than on sea ice, increasing calf mortality from possible stampedes and forcing adults to travel further to find food. Kit Kovacs of the Norwegian Polar Institute notes how the sea ice around the Svalbard archipelago is dramatically different from just 12 years ago.
Just suddenly, unpredicted, unprecedented collapse in sea ice. And it really hasn't recovered. So we're seeing profound changes, many of which are quite difficult to document because the traditional tools available to us, like flying surveys at molting to count seals on sea ice, are obviously no longer possible without sea ice.
Kovacs says they're observing behavioral changes. Seals, for example, have to travel further to find food, dive deeper and for a longer period of time, and they have little time to rest.
All of which means, of course, it costs much more to get the food that you require, and that will eventually have reproductive consequences and growth consequences for these animals. And you see that kind of phenomenon in many different species right now.
Polar bears usually hunt seals on the sea ice, but remember that bird researcher that we heard from earlier? Kathy Kulitz of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She says polar bears have been observed foraging for food by going after ground-nesting common eiders or cliff-nesting mers.
When the bears show up, they disturb the birds fly off. So that not only means that the bears are going after the chicks and eggs that they can get on the cliffs, but when the adult birds leave, the other predators like gulls will come in.
The 200-page report on Arctic marine biodiversity was produced by an Arctic Council working group that focuses on the conservation of flora and fauna. It incorporates the work of 60 scientists from around the world, including three researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, poetry and prank calls. Juno poet Ishmael Hope has released his new book of poetry titled Rock Piles Along the Eddy. KTOO's Scott Burton spoke with Hope and brings us this preview of a new collection 2 years in the making.
Kagwask ikatusak. My thinking name is Kagwask. My Nupak name, Uvanga Atinga Angluk. My Nupak name is Angluk. And I'm a poet and performer, storyteller. And I'm grateful to be here.
Hope sits on the back deck of a valley home on a chilly blue sky morning. It's a quiet place in a house full of kids. His graying black hair is pulled into a ponytail, and small, reddish, rectangular glasses frame his eyes above a full beard. To exemplify his work, Hope chooses a piece called Canoe Launching into the Gaslit Sea.
Now, as much as ever and as always, we need to band together, form a lost tribe, scatter as one, burst through rifle barrels guided by the spider's crosshairs. We need to knit wool sweaters for a brother sleeping under the freeway, hand him our wallets, and bathe his feet in holy water.
Free time to speak with a reporter does not come easily to Hope. At 35, he's the father of four with, newsflash, a fifth on the way with his wife, Clinket Weaver Lily Hope. Lily is watching the children inside, but they'll need to switch soon so she can weave. The deadline for her museum-commissioned Chilcat robe looms.
It doesn't get any better than this with, you know, raising a family and being supported by our artistic community and having our dreams come true. It's pretty unreal.
But she says it's not all joy and happiness.
The financial stress of being two full-time artists is the hardest part. We understand each other from an artistic point of, like, go after what it is that you want to go after, but then we're always thinking, like, who's going to make the money this month, or who's paying these bills, or how do we negotiate that when both of us kind of want to jump?
Ishmael is also working on a Master of Fine Arts degree in creative writing from the Institute of American Indian Arts, is co-directing a documentary on Tlingit art here at KTOO, and is working on curriculum for Gold Belt Heritage on Tlingit language learning.
What does it mean to be Indigenous? What does Indigenous thinking and being and feeling, how does that translate into the world? How do we express that? How do we emit that? How do we let that, I think, waft in the work, in the language? A lot of what I was trying to do with this collection, Rock Piles Along the Eddy, was explore Indigenous thought.
Rock Piles Along the Eddy, which is a reference to a Tlingit tradition of creating salmon-friendly eddies with rock piles, is 70 pages long with 44 poems.
We need to find our lost sister, last seen hitchhiking Highway 16, or panhandling on the streets of Anchorage, couch searching with relatives in Victoria, or kicking out her boyfriend after a week of partying in a trailer park in Salem, Oregon.
As inspiration, Hope mentions poets like Federico Garcia Lorca and Pablo Neruda, and masters of oral tradition.
What I happen to be doing is a lot of writing in English, but I want that life breath, that thing I feel in my body when I hear a story from George Davis or Paul Marx or Marie Olson.
He says there can be a divide between how the two art forms are discussed, poetry and oral tradition, and he's trying to lessen it. It's important to Hope that people recognize that Native literature began long before Native people started writing it down. Poetry and oral tradition are not the same, he says, but both should be in dialogue when discussing Native literature.
And so part of my work, what I'm trying to do here, is actually let those spaces bleed into each other just a little bit. Just a little bit. And that actually, I feel, makes my writing all the richer for it. Now, as much as ever and as always, we need to register together, lock arms at the front lines, brand ourselves with mutant DNA strands, atomic whorls, and serial numbers, adding ourselves to the blacklist. You know, this is really not fashionable writing. It's not the thing that's going to get awards and be prestigious. And I don't care. I really don't. You know, I'm trying to write the work that connects to people, connects to the community, whether they're poetry fans or whether they've never picked up a poetry book. Now, as much as ever and as always, we need to prank call our senators,
take selfies with the authorities at fundraisers we weren't invited to.
From a backyard in Juneau's Mendenhall Valley, I'm Scott Burton.
We need to rub salve on the belly of our hearts.
To hear the full version of Hope's canoe launching into the gaslit sea, check out our website, alaskapublic.org. Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from James Hart in Haines. Hart is a young tribal council member of the Chilkoot Indian Association and a delegate on the Tlingit and Haida Central Council. He received an Emerging Leader Award from the council last month.
What led me to get involved with Tlingit and Haida Central Council as a delegate was probably based off my mother, first of all. She's been involved all throughout my life, and it wasn't until I was older and started asking more questions that she started to prompt me to look at being involved. I went to National Congress of American Indians probably about 5 years ago now, and there was thousands of Native Americans from across the country there, all fighting the same issues that we're fighting here in our hometown in Haines. I'd say the biggest issue for everybody is sovereignty and figuring out how to use our sovereignty. I think that's the one thing that I'd really like to see, is figuring out how we could solely rely on ourselves and not the federal government or the state. A lot of our funding comes federally, and if the federal government doesn't like tribes, then that means we're not going to get a seat at the table. And most of the time, if you don't have a seat at the table, you're part of the meal. You're what's on the table. Awards for myself are kind of interesting. It's not something that I want to go after. But to be acknowledged was really nice, and to have that acknowledgement meant a lot to me. I was trying to hide it for as long as I could. And a funny story was, President Peterson saw my mom on a plane, and he asked her, "Hey, what'd you think about your son's award?" And she said, "What award?" And I neglected to tell my mother until after she texted me afterwards and got on me about it.
James Hart lives in Haines. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Scott Burton, Emily Files, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jacob Resnick and Matt Miller in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our web editor, is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.